appreciate so much when we do have the preaching that you listen. And I appreciated so much Pastor Weber's message this morning. I sense that God had given him a burden. When you read the Old Testament, you'll often find this phrase called the burden of the Lord. And if you're not a preacher, you may not understand it, but if you're a preacher, you understand it. Sometimes the Lord gives you a burden, and you cannot find any satisfaction until you deliver the burden. And certainly we saw that happen this morning. And I believe God has another burden for us here now that I'm burdened about, and I hope that you'll listen. Because again, as Pastor Weber said, and we certainly want to emphasize it, there's some young people out here who do not believe that God can use you. Now, for whatever reason, you think something's wrong with you, maybe things that were said to you, things that have happened, even maybe sinful cycles in your own life, you have come to an unbiblical a conclusion that somehow you are not usable. And a young person, I will tell you, do not let your life be defined by your sinful past. You need to be defined by what the Bible says. And the Bible does tell us you can do all things through Christ. Whatever God's will is, He can enable you to do it. And often God uses even failures in the past to enable you and help you in the future. Can I put it this way? God loves to take stumbling blocks and turn them into stepping stones. And so I want you to listen this morning because I want to preach a message out of Hebrews 11. Hebrews 11, if you want to go to Hebrews chapter 11, and we're going to preach a message, Hebrews 11, 1, what does faith do? What does faith do? If you're ever around Baptist College of Ministry or Falls Baptist Church, I think one thing the Lord has given this ministry a burden about is challenging people to believe God. And challenging people not to live in self-dependence, but to live in dependence upon God. And certainly I know that truth has been life-changing for me and continues to be. So I want to kind of deal on that particular theme. What does faith do? For years I thought Hebrews 11:1 was a definition of faith. I don't believe that anymore after further study. And you'll find this as you grow in your understanding of the Bible. Sometimes your perspective will change a little bit. And many, it's like this. Sometimes people say, I don't really agree with your position. Sometimes I have to say, well, I don't agree with myself 10 years ago. But anyway, why? Because you grow. You have a greater understanding. God illumines your heart. And you see things, maybe a little different understanding of the Word of God, and God makes it clearer what the passage means. And that's what happened to me in Hebrews 11:1. I was a little puzzled by what the definition of faith, and I tried to work with it. But then when it hit me that this is not a definition of faith, it's telling us what faith does. Now let's start, though, with what is faith. What is faith? Now, Mr. Bosler mentioned this a moment ago, and it certainly has become a rallying cry. It's on our sleeves. Anybody wearing a The Generation polo knows it's on our sleeves, total surrender and total dependence. What is faith? I will tell you, faith is a total surrender to the will of God and a total dependence on His strength to do it. That's it. It's 0% my will, 100% God's will. It's 0% my strength and 100% of God's strength. It's getting out of the boat like we talked, like Peter did, and trusting God to enable us to do what we could never do unless God enabled us to do it. That's why, young person, doesn't matter your background, your skill set, what you think you have or don't have. If you get out of the boat and in obedience to the Lord Jesus and follow Him, He will enable you to do things you never thought you could do. And He will enable you, even in ministry, He'll open doors you never thought would open, and He'll give you opportunities you never thought would happen. And our burden at Baptist College of Ministry, that some of you, I'm sure, that are sitting here, God's going to call you here, is to develop that and stir you to take steps of faith, to believe God. Get out of the boat and do things you never thought you could do because you can't do them in your own strength. You got to trust Jesus. But get out of the boat. Use physical strength to get out of the boat, but don't trust the physical strength. Trust Jesus to enable you to do what you never thought you could do, and He will enable you. And when you look away from Jesus to the storms of life and begin to sink, the answer is always the same. Lord, rescue me. Lord, save me. And the Lord Jesus is always the answer for every problem you face. So that's what faith is. It's a total trust, total surrender to the will of God, total dependence on His grace to live it. It certainly is the rallying cry of The Generation. If you've ever noticed with our podcast, we always try to sign off with the same thing to keep it before you, total surrender, total dependence. 0% my will, 100% His. 0% my strength, 100% His. Okay, so that brings us to the message. Okay, if you understand what faith is, it's depending on Jesus, stepping out, doing His will through His strength, not yours. Okay, then what does faith do? So when you come to that point of dependence on the Lord and step out, what happens? Now, several of the testimonies that have been given have actually been living illustrations about what I'm about to preach. But the passage here says here, now faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. Now, there are two sides of the definition. They're actually, I believe, two different pictures of the same truth. Number one, Faith is the substance of things hoped for. Now, every young person in this room, I would assume, has some kind of hopes about life. Maybe there's a young man out here or a young lady who hopes you one day will be president of the United States. Now, I'm going to be honest with you, that's probably an unrealistic hope. You know why? Because there's probably a million other kids who thought the same thing. Somebody's going to be disappointed. You with me on that? Okay, so sometimes hopes are unrealistic. Some of you guys out here probably think one day you're going to be an NBA basketball player. I saw you this morning on the basketball court. May I tell you, it's not going to happen. Okay, so unrealistic hopes. Okay, so sometimes we have unrealistic hopes. We really do. And sometimes there might be a little more realistic, but that's not what we're talking about. When the Bible talks about hopes, it is talking about a confident expectation. The Bible definition of hope is confident expectation if it's a noun. If it's the verb hope, it is expectant reliance. I remember about 20 years ago, God really burdened my heart about the word hope. That I was supposed to live a life of confident expectation and expectant reliance, burdened me so much with it that my last child, I gave her that middle name, Hope. Because it's a great truth. In fact, every one of my daughters has a part of the journey, their middle names, in my own life. And I want you to understand, young people, that hope is a wonderful truth. It's the idea of expectingly relying on God. And so God says confident expectation. Now, obviously every promise of the Bible and every principle of the Bible is something you can expect God to do because He said it. So what is faith as a substance? Okay, faith is a substance, and we can take that word substance. It's literally that which stands under. So the idea of the word is substance. We could use it in modern day. We'd have the idea of substantiate. Okay, substance means it stands under. It substantiates. Okay, so faith substantiates Bible hopes. Let me give you an illustration. At 16 years old, I remember the day I walked down the aisle. The Marquette Manor Baptist Church, it was a little chapel at the time. It was a packed out Sunday night. Probably 250, 300 people packed in an auditorium that barely seat that. Remember that night, my dad preached, and I remember coming down that aisle. I could fight it no longer, grabbing my dad's hand and saying, I think God's called me to preach. Little tears streaming down my face. I said, Dad, I think God's called me to preach. I will never forget what my dad said. He said, Son, your mother and I have known it for a long time. We've been praying for you. Totally stunned me. Absolutely shocked me. They never gave me any indication of that. They certainly did not want to call me to preach. They wanted to make sure it was God. Well, I will tell you, young person, at that point, my faith in my call was not substantiated. All I had was verses like this. Faithful is he that calleth you, who also will do it. One of the reasons I fought the call to preach was very simple. I didn't think I could do it. I really didn't think I could do it. And you know the truth is, I was right. But see, what I didn't realize at the time is if God calls you, He will equip you. You've heard me say this before, those that have been around here. God does not call the equipped. He equips the called. And when you respond to the call, God does it. He does it. He does it. He just does it. He equips you. He enables you. He takes your life experience. He weaves it into His will for your life. And you look back and think, that's amazing. So when God called me to preach at 16, 1 Thessalonians 5:24 was just theory. It was just theory. God, you said you're faithful. If you call me, you're going to do it. But I don't have any life experience that you're going to do it in my own life. All I have is a promise and a source. That's all I needed. But you know, in 35 years of now full-time ministry, almost 35 years, do you know what I can say? It's no longer theory. It's reality. For 35 years, I have watched God do it. And I'll be honest with you, young person, every man knows his own heart. And it is amazing to me. I was talking texting somebody just a moment ago, and basically they said the same thing. It's amazing. It's just amazing. And it is. It's amazing. It's absolutely amazing. You know what is happening? Over these 35 years, as I've followed God's call on my life, you know what God has done? He has substantiated my confident expectation. And I'm not sure my expectation was that confident, but He has substantiated my Bible hope. So faith, that's what faith does. When you believe God enough to follow and obey Him, to trusting His strength, not yours, He brings experience into your life that substantiates Bible hopes. So they're no longer theory, now they're reality. So if I were to preach on 1 Thessalonians 5:24, I could preach it with conviction. Why? For 35 years, I have watched God do what I thought was impossible and really was. And He will do the same in your life too. That's what faith does. Now, notice what the other side says. It's the evidence of things that are not seen. The evidence of things not seen. You say, ooh, that sounds a little spooky. Well, it's really not. Some of you this morning got out in that ball game. In fact, I did the same. You heard me announce it. And we said, there's wind. Now, I hate to tell you this. None of us saw the wind this morning. None of us did. All we experienced was the effects of it. We felt something cold against us, and it seemed to get a little bit stronger as the game go on. We saw the big ball, you know, pitch different ways. We saw people like Thomas Hames shoot the ball, who was lights out like yesterday. Nothing would go in. And all we said was, it's windy out. Why? Because we saw the ball curve and went places. So we had saw evidence, and the evidence brought us to a conviction that, hey, it's windy out here. Leaves maybe were blowing across the street. Hats blew off our heads, okay. And it brought us to the conclusion, hey, it is windy out. Evidence. In fact, that word, evidence, that has the idea of evidence that brings you to conviction. That's the idea of things you can't see. So certainly wind would be an example of that. I don't know why, but maybe you've done this too. A hurricane's about to make landfall. We saw Florence just a couple months ago or a few weeks ago, and then Michael just a short time ago. And we've got a few Florida friends here. And I don't know why we Midwesterners do this, but I do this. I'll get on weather.com, and you got some rookie report there out there on the beach. You know what I'm talking about? Hey, the hurricane's making landfall. I'm thinking, man, that's just... Have you ever noticed the rookies? They're about 22 years old, fresh out of college, and that you never see them again. That's their last time that you ever see them is out there on the beach, and they're out there, you know, and then, you know, you got waves coming in and have fish flying by and palm trees. You say to yourself, wow, it's windy down there. Now, you didn't see the wind. You saw evidence. Now, let's go to that word evidence, evidence that drives to a conviction. Back when I lived in Greenville, South Carolina, I don't know why, I went down to the courthouse a lot on jury duty. Now, the way they did it in Greenville, South Carolina is they had a big jury pool on Monday. They would pick all the juries out on Monday for the entire week. So if you didn't get picked on Monday, you got to go home for the week. So your goal would be not get picked. Now, I had a surefire strategy, and it always worked. I never got picked. You say, what was your strategy? Okay, it was real easy. They would have the jury pool. And they go around the jury pool. Of course, you have the lawyers for the defense and the lawyers for the prosecution. And they go around the jury pool and they'd say, tell us what you do for a living. And I would say something like, I'm an independent Baptist evangelist. And you could just see it on their faces. Oh, he's one of those. I remember I was in a jury pool for a drunk driving incident. And the judge, it was a real mean looking guy. And the judge gets up and the judge says, do any of you have a conviction against the consumption of alcohol? Now, if I was in a jury pool in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, I wouldn't expect anybody to raise their hand. But I'm in Greenville, South Carolina. I thought the buckle on the Bible belt, I thought a lot of people would raise their hands. So I'll shoot up my hand like this, look around, there's one other person raising their hand, this entire jury pool. And so the judge looks at me and says, sir, could I speak to you for a moment? Now, please don't take offense at this, but there's two kinds of people I'd really rather not have personal conversations with, and that is judges and principals. You know what I'm talking about? And I've kind of gotten over the principal thing now since I work with them every week, but I still got a thing for judges. I don't know. I just, no offense, if you're a judge, I just not, you're probably never going to be my best friend. But anyway, and so I come up there, real mean-looking guy, stern-looking. I felt like I was back in the principal's office, and he looks at me, not that I was there often, but anyway, I had friends who knew a whole lot more about it than I did. But I remember the judge looking at me kind of real stern like. He says, sir, do you believe you can set aside your convictions and you can judge this case on the merits of the United States law? Now, how do you answer a question like that? So I looked at him and said, I'll give it a try, but I don't guarantee anything. They didn't pick me. Okay, so I got out of it. Okay, now, why would I not want to be in a jury? Well, there's several reasons, but one would be this. I'm going to have to make a decision that will affect people's lives about something I didn't see. And the defense and the prosecution are going to parade in front of the jury evidence. And that evidence is designed to bring you to conviction about something you didn't see. Now, here's what God says faith does. When you believe God enough to obey Him, when you get out of the boat and trust God to enable you to walk on water, when you have a total surrender to the will of God and total dependence on His grace to live it, you know what you will find God? God will do. He will bring evidence into your life that will bring you to a conviction about something, about the things of God that you cannot see. You ask me how I know He lives? He lives within my heart. I think the songwriter understood what I'm talking about. For some of you, that's not true yet. You see, young person, all I can put it is this way. When you learn to, when God begins to work in your life and you trust Him and you begin to follow Him, He brings evidence to your life about things you cannot see. And so you know God's real. You see, the spiritual realm is a realm you cannot see. When it comes to God, the Bible says God is a spirit. And they that worship Him must worship Him in spirit and in truth. The way you connect with God is not through your five senses. You see, every single one of you out here uses your five senses to assimilate reality. That's how you determine what's real. As you were born into this world, you begin to assimilate reality through your five senses. But you cannot do that with God, because He is not worshipped through the five senses. He's a spirit. And the only way you can connect with God is in the spiritual realm. It's the realm you cannot see. It's the eternal realm. The Bible says everything you can see is temporal. One day it will be gone. But the things which you cannot see are eternal. And some of you in this room are living for that which you can see. It's like this, friends. In high school, you make a decision. Am I going to live for that which I can see, or live for that which I cannot see? Some of you have made the decision to live for that which you can see. I'm not trying to be unkind, but I'm going to try to tell you this. When you die, you will leave it all. There's one thing I observed in my short life, and that is this. There are no U-Hauls behind hearses. Have you ever noticed that? When John D. Rockefeller died, and they asked somebody that knew, how much did he leave? The answer was all of it. And I will promise you, I don't care who you are in this room, you die, you will leave everything you can see. It will all be left behind. And I remember when I was in high school, imperfectly, greatly imperfectly, and certainly the pursuit of God has been imperfect. But the point is, I made a decision. I'm going to live for that which I cannot see. And every one of you is making a decision. Am I going to live for that which I can see, or am I going to live for that which I cannot see? And if you live for that which you cannot see, you will find as you believe God, take steps of obedience and dependence on His strength, not yours, He will bring evidence into your life that will firm up your conviction about things you cannot see. And you will have great confidence in God. That's why my grandmother could literally, when my dad was just a little boy, he remembers her walking on the around the house when hurricane winds were howling. And danger was all around them. And Miami was right there on the coast. And my grandmother is going around the house, clapping her hands and saying, "Isn't God powerful? Look at God. He's scaring all these unsaved people. They're all scared to death. What a great God we have." Now, I'm going to ask you, why wasn't she hunkered down, scared half to death? I'm going to tell you why. Because she knew the God who made the hurricane. She wasn't worried about it. All I'm simply telling you, friend, is faith, when you believe God enough to obey Him, He brings evidence into your life that firms up your convictions about things you cannot see. I'm talking to some of you in this room, God is not just right now theory to you. There's others in this room. I know several Baptist College ministry students. God's not theory anymore. He's reality. You know why? Some of you met with Him this morning. You met with Him a couple of days ago. You met with Him a week ago. You met with Him 3 weeks ago. There's a consistent time in your life, a daily life, where you meet with God. You ask me how I know He lives? He walks with me. He talks with me. And He tells me I am His own. And the joy we share as we tarry there, none other has ever known. Yeah, I think the songwriter, that song sometimes is mocked and made fun of. And every time I hear people make fun of it, I say, man, do you understand what you're making fun of? This is what it's talking about, fellowshipping with God. It's the unseen realm becoming a reality. So much so that you almost use it in human terminology. Wow. Understand it, friend. I feel sorry for every young person in this room that chooses to live for the here and now. I hope you get to heaven. Again, I hope you're a believer is what I mean, because if you're saved. But if you live for the here and now, when we get to heaven, I'm going to feel so bad for you, because you won't have anything. You'll have left it all here and all gets burned up. And I'm just going to urge you, young person. Faith is the substance of things hoped for. It substantiates Bible hopes. It brings evidence into your life that drives you to conviction about things you cannot see. So you become convinced about the unseen realm. And you know there's a God. And you know He's real. He's your friend. You meet with Him. He answers your prayer. He fellowship. He meets your needs. He comforts you. He strengthens you. He enables you. He's your friend. So that's what faith does. Now, let me use what I would call a fairly common illustration. It's one that would be in the experience of some. It's certainly not a Bible illustration, but perhaps the illustration will help, because sometimes people say, well, I've made decisions to follow God, and I've tried to follow God, but it just isn't working for me. Okay, maybe this illustration will help. It's not a Bible illustration. It just comes out of human experience. But how many out here would say that you would be somebody who would kind of fairly much you like roller coasters? Could I see your hands, please? Okay. Several of you like roller coasters. I had an older sister. She's now with the Lord. But I had an older sister who never met a roller coaster she didn't absolutely love. I never remember fear ever being in the face of my sister, Joy. She, many of you knew her. She was a kind, gentle soul. But she loved roller coasters. I mean, loved roller coasters. And it didn't matter how dramatic it was, she loved roller coasters. Now, as a result of that, there were times I rode roller coasters that I didn't want to ride. You know what I'm talking about? How are you going to chicken out when your older sister isn't afraid? You know what I'm talking about? It's kind of hard. You know what I'm talking about? So let me just put it this way. Let's imagine, and I use, I think, this illustration at the opening for some, but that we're here. But let's imagine you were into physics. Anybody out here kind of like physics? You know, you're into, okay, got a few people that kind of like physics. Okay, you study the G's, you know, the G-forces of roller coasters. And, of course, negative G's is when you press down on the seat, feel like you weigh 500 pounds. Positive G's when you're pretty sure you're going to be thrown to your death. You know what I'm talking about. And the back and forth of roller coasters, they try to go back and forth from positive, negative G's and drops and speed. And pretty soon, you just study all the North American roller coasters and you come to a conclusion that there's one roller coaster you're pretty sure it's going to be, pardon the excuse, the expression, but it's going to be the funnest roller coaster in North America. I mean, it's got just the most physics, you know, as far as physics are concerned, it's going to be a fun roller coaster. So what do you have to do to bring evidence that drives you to conviction that it's a great roller coaster? What do you have to do to substantiate your hopes that it's a fun roller coaster? What do you have to do? And the answer is, you got to ride it. Now, before you ride it, there is a very important experience, and that is the experience of getting in line. And that is part of the experience. It really is. Now, back when I was a kid, I'd get in line, and my older sister would be in line, and she wasn't afraid at all. She's laughing. I'm planning my funeral. You know what I'm talking about? And she's laughing. She's not, you could tell she was not afraid at all. I'm getting nervous. I'm really getting nervous. You know, I'm. You maybe you know what I'm talking about. Maybe if you have a younger sister that likes roller coasters, that's worse. And you're thinking, why did I get in line? But if you get out of line, your sister will probably make fun of you the rest of your life. And there are some things death is better than. You know what I'm talking about? And so you get in line, and you're trying to act cool, you know, trying to act like, hey, I'm not, this doesn't bother me at all. And, you know, there comes that very first warning sign. You know what I'm talking about? They have those warning signs. Warning. If you have a heart condition, please do not ride this ride. You think, well, I didn't when I got in line, but I think I'm getting one. You know what I'm talking about? Your heart starts beating out of your chest. Go a little further. Warning, if you have skeletal problems, please do not ride this ride. You're thinking, I'm going to be maimed for life. And then your mind starts playing tricks. You know what I'm talking about? You're hearing people you're sure are falling from the roller coaster to certain deaths. You're hearing medevac helicopters coming in, taking out the dead and wounded. It's all playing in your mind. It's not happening, but you think it's happening. You hear ambulance sirens, and I mean, it's getting bad. And then there comes the final warning. Warning, if you have ingrown toenails, do not ride this ride. Thinking, what do ingrown toenails have to do with it? You know what I'm talking about. You're thinking, this is unbelievable. Then you come right up to the ride, and you look at your sister, and she's just having a great time. And there it is. There it is. There it is. The chicken exit. You say now, hey, preacher, I have never seen it. Oh, yeah, you've seen a chicken exit. It's got a little wheelchair sign on it. That's what it is, okay? You just go the wheelchair out. You go out backwards out there. That's how you get it. That's the chicken exit. You guys didn't know that, did you? Okay. But anyway, or you know how it is. You act like you're getting on the roller coaster, but then you get out like you just rode it, and you just walk all the way out. Just go right through. That's the other way to kind of do the chicken exit. You say, preacher, how do you know? Hey, I know these things. Okay, but anyway, so here it is. You're right there with your sister. And you're thinking, oh, I want to chicken out. I do not want to ride this ride. But you look at your sister, oh, I got to do it. So you get in, your sister's on one seat, you're in the next seat, and that, you know, that big thing comes down, click. Now for me, every time I hear click, every time, there is one thought comes into my mind. You are such an idiot. That's my very first thought. Like, why did you do this? Why are you doing this? And you pull out of the station, and boy, it seems like an eternity. Click, 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 click. That's when my prayer life gets better. You know what I'm talking about? I'm starting to sing, Lord, I'm coming home. I mean, the whole thing. Up the hill, click, 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 click. And then the top of the hill is the greatest. You know what I'm talking about? Click, click, click. Oh, we're going to get stuck. We're going to get stuck. Click, boom, down it goes. In the next 120 minutes, excuse me, seconds. Sometimes it feels like 120 minutes are a blur. I mean, curves, upside down, whatever, you know what it is. I've been in the ones in the dark, backwards, whatever. I've done, I don't know how many. I think I've ridden my last roller coaster. I don't like blood just going on one side of my body. But anyway, it takes it all out of your brain for one. But which some of you need brain activity. Okay, but anyway, so about 120 seconds later, it pulls into that station. And you get off the roller coaster, and I'll tell you exactly what you do because I did it. You go, man, that was great. Let's do it again. Why? Because evidence has come into your life to bring you to a conviction about something you didn't see. And now, friends, you have substantiated your hope. This is a great roller coaster. And you come back, oh, you got to ride that roller coaster. It's so much fun. Okay, why? Because you've substantiated your hope. You got evidence that drives you to conviction about something you couldn't see before. Now, it's a human illustration, but here's the point. God's worked in some of your hearts. I was grateful for the response this morning, although I'm sure there's others that needed to go. And I'm sure last night, same thing as Pastor Weber, I think very appropriately burdened from the Lord, told us exactly what we needed to hear this morning. But here's the problem. Some of you say, okay, I'm going to do it. I'm going to get in line. And you get in line. And you know what happens? Satan will try to scare you to death. He'll say, warning, you're going to be grounded for life. Warning, your parents are going to really be upset. Warning. And you know what a lot of young people I've seen, thank the Lord, not an enormous amount, but I've seen too many, hit the chicken exit. Instead of getting on the roller coaster of believing God, and if you get on the roller coaster of believing God, you will have evidence that drives you to conviction about things you cannot see. You will have substantiate Bible hopes. And when you get off that roller coaster, you say, man, that is great. Let's do it again. And I appreciated so much what Thomas Hames said this morning. What did he say? He said, you know, if I had to go back and do it again, and talk about getting right with God, getting in line, and believing what God said about coming completely clean with all the people he needed to come clean with, his pastor, his mom, and all those situations, he said, if it came to having to do it again, he said, I wouldn't even think about it. I'd do it again. Why? Because he rode the roller coaster, and when he got off the roller coaster of believing God and believing truth, you know what happened? He said, man, that was great. Let's do it again. In other words, I'm going to keep open with God. I'm going to trust God, believe God. And you see, that's the point. But if you hit the chicken exit, you won't substantiate Bible hope. You won't have evidence that drives you to conviction about things you cannot see. And I'm just pleading with young people here this morning. Because some of you are this afternoon, there's some of you in this room right now that have gotten in the line and perhaps you have full intention to come completely through, and let me urge you, please do it. Don't corner cut what God tells you to do. Don't hit the chicken exit. Come completely clean. Tell your parents everything they need to. Get right with the people that love you. Get right with those that are biblically right to get right with. Do those faith steps that we talked about last night that desperately need to be done. Do it all. Why? Because when you do, you have evidence that drives you to conviction about things you cannot see. God substantiates Bible hopes. And you realize, wow, believing God, that's the greatest thing. Let's do it again. But if you hit the chicken exit, you don't know that. I'm talking to some of you right now, right in the throes. Are you going to completely come clean, completely do what God wants you to do? And I'll tell you, there's more at stake than you can even imagine. What does faith do? I remember several years ago, it was 1994 to be exact, I was in... going to be in a town in Pennsylvania, small church, but it had a Christian school. Christian school was a little bit bigger than you'd think of for that size of church. But I remember that I called up to the pastor. I'd been there, I think, one or two times before, and the pastor is still alive, though he's much older now, and an older man that is retired. And I remember I called him up. He was quite a bit older than I am, and I said, Pastor, I said, we're going to be there in a few weeks, and we began to talk, and he said, now, Brother Van Gelderen, he said, do not be offended by this. He said, but I am not bringing your team in to win area teenagers to the Lord. Now, he said, don't get me wrong. I hope some of them get saved. But he said, our Christian school is really in trouble. And he said, I really want you to minister in our Christian school. Now, at that time, there was no war special forces. For those of you that are familiar with our Minutemen Ministries, no war special forces is primarily geared to Christian schools. There was just the war, which is basically your Cola Clash war template, and the school year comes in on a Wednesday, does Saturday, Sunday, Monday night evangelistic rallies, leaves on Tuesday. That's what we were doing. There was no special forces, but God had been working in my heart, saying very clearly to me, you need to develop a war for Christian schools. I could not believe it when the pastor said this. I said, Pastor, I said, God's been burdening me for Christian schools. I said, could we use you as a guinea pig? And I'm pretty sure I used even those words. And he said, absolutely. He said, you tell us what you want us to do, and we will do everything you ask us to do. Now, you don't understand how rare that is. That was unbelievable. I thought, wow, God's working. So we kind of developed a program, sent him what we'd like to do. And of course, they approved everything like he said he would do. And we got there, and I will tell you, it was a very difficult Christian school. The kids were, they were so hard that I would consider them to be rude. Now, many Christian schools are very nice to you, and they get involved in the games, but they're just locked down spiritually. These kids, I guess before we ever arrived, they'd get basically locked down as a group, corporately locked down. So you'd sit down and maybe start talking to them, and they would act like you're not even there. And my two team captains were very competitive guys, and we were out there in the games the very first day on Thursday. I'll never forget, I think we were doing big ball volleyball, and the ball would cross the line, and literally high school guys would step out of the way and let the ball hit the ground, just to spite the team captain. Now, my guys, I thought they were going to strangle some of the kids. I really did. I had to pull them aside later. I said, no, that's what they want you to do. They want you to react. Don't react. We were in a battle, and we knew it. I didn't understand things. I mean, I'd never really been through something like this. We were just looking to God. I mean, we didn't know what else to do. I mean, we just didn't have any experience. So Thursday was rough, Friday was rough, nothing's happened in the school, and it's just the lockdown. Well, on Saturday, of course, we have no Christian school, Saturday, Sunday, that's why we do Special Forces Sunday through Friday now, but there was nothing on Saturday, and I kind of knew that, and we kind of got the word that the high school wasn't coming, and that's pretty much what they did. They boycotted it. It was active. It was organized. And now we had a good crowd from the outside. The team captains were good recruiters, had a good crowd from the outside, but we didn't have many school kids, not hardly any. Some of the junior high kids were not a part of what was going on. They were there, but that was about it. And so we had the night that night, had a good first night when it comes to just sheer war night. It was good. Had some kids saved. And then it came for Sunday night, and Sunday night I was pretty sure that some of the Christian school kids would come because some of you Christian school kids know what I'm talking about. They would know that they either had to go to church or they'd have to go to the war. And so many of them said, well, I'd rather go to the war. So they would ask their parents, okay, could I go to the war? And some of the parents said, sure. One of them was a pastor's son. His name was John. He had several siblings. And evidently his dad, he was a pastor of a different church. And his dad said, sure, you can go to the war. And so his dad brought him over before the service, dropped him off, and then went back, of course, to preach and run the service at his church. And so John was there. John was a junior in high school, 16 years old, very popular kid. And He was definitely one of the popular kids, one of the leaders, and so it was good to see him. But nonetheless, we went through the night, and he got into things, and came time for the preaching. I'll never forget this. I preached a simple message. I've preached it many times, just a gospel message. Came to the very end and said, if you're a hellbound sinner concerned about your soul, raise your hand. And John raised his hand. I thought that was a little strange. I didn't know. Gave the invitation. All of a sudden, John stood up, and John was sobbing. He just sobbing. I was the farthest from one from him as he left the room, and he's just sobbing. Well, I don't know, 20 minutes he was counseled, dealt with, and he came back out. Now he's softly crying. He's not sobbing, but he's still crying. And by this time, most everybody was gone, but it was just he and his siblings eventually that were left because the dad had to finish the service and had time to come pick him up yet. So I don't know, it was 20, 25, maybe 30 minutes. I just noticed John crying. Finally, I couldn't take it anymore. I walked up to him and said, okay, John, what in the world is going on? And here's what he said. He said, Brother Van Gelderen, he said, you were preaching tonight, and he said, while you were preaching, God told me, if you don't get saved tonight, you will go to hell. And he just sobbed. He sobbed because he believed he got saved at his last opportunity. I can't explain it totally. All I'm saying is he was convinced. He was convinced he got saved at his last opportunity. Well, I thought, wow, God's doing something. Well, the next morning, word had gotten out. Any of you that go to Christian schools know what I'm talking about. Word had gotten out. Now, all John did that night was get right with God, deal with some of his own, get saved, deal with maybe some of his own issues. But he certainly didn't implicate anybody else, though I know there were people to be implicated. But in a Christian school, when something like happens, word got out. Hey, did you hear about John? He cracked. And kids are nervous because John knows too much. You with me on this? So they're afraid, oh, John's going to tell on us, we're done. You know, that's, you could just sense it. You could just, and John hadn't said a word, but you could just sense it. Everybody's nervous. What did John, what did he say, what did he do? You know, that kind of thing. Well, we're doing our final war day, and you could just sense the tension in the room. You could just sense it. And we did a few competition things. Kids, I could tell, weren't that interested. And came time for the preaching, and John stood up. He was over on this side. It was kind of two sides, and John stood up, and he looked at me and said, Brother Van Gelder, could I say something? I'm thinking to myself, sure. I mean, I've preached now for several times, and sure, go ahead. And he stands up, comes to the front. I'll never forget this. He has a cardboard box, and in the cardboard box, he had cassette tapes. Now, I know most of you have no clue what a cassette tape is, but anyway, cassette tapes. And he had taken the magnetic tape, and he had pulled all the magnetic tape out, so there were just the cassette tapes on the bottom and just literally loaded with magnetic tape. It just looked like a box full of magnetic tape. He comes up, he sets it on the platform, which is about 2 feet up. We're on the main floor. And he looks to the student body, and he tells them what God did the night before. I mean, you could have heard a pin drop. I mean, everybody's listening. Then he basically says, now that I'm a Christian, he said, you see that music? He said, I don't need that junk music in my life anymore. I'm burning it tonight. He said, we're going to build a fire tonight, and I'm going to burn my music. And he said, some of you got garbage in your life. He said, I know, because I've been doing it with you. He said, you put it in the box, and we'll burn it together tonight. Man, I'm telling you, you could have heard a pin drop. Kids couldn't believe it. They could not believe it. So John sits down. I get up to preach. I'll never forget, I'm preaching about halfway through this message. I don't know how to explain it. But very clearly, the Spirit of God said to me, you need to stop right now. I'm in the middle of the message. This has never happened quite this way. I've had some other unusual things happen, but you say, how did you know? I don't know how to say it, but God is light and in him is no darkness. I knew it. I knew it. I knew if I preached that message, at that point, I'd be disobedient. So I tried to finish it. It was like crash landing, but tried to finish it as quickly as I could. Gave the invitation. I'll never forget that invitation. It was literally like a spiritual neutron bomb went off. There was collateral damage everywhere. I mean, kids were just, literally, our team, I think, was doing spiritual triage for about an hour, maybe two hours, about an hour or two. Literally, I remember about after an hour walking down a hallway, kids in the hallway, us weeping. I sit down next to him and say, hey, bud, what's going on? He said, man, I'm going straight to hell. Lead him to Jesus. It was that simple. Literally, all over the campus, God was working everywhere. A remarkable thing. And God broke the whole thing. The assistant pastor of that church, who was the son of the pastor, who's now pastors his own church in a same state but a different church, and he has told me on several occasions, he said, that revival, he said, it just was not a flash in the pan. He said, it changed our school. It changed our school. And I'm going to tell you why. Because of one young man, 16 years old, maybe not even been saved a day, who decided to believe God enough to obey him, in dependence on God's strength, not his. And you know what God did? He brought evidence into his life that brought him to conviction about things you cannot see, and there are a lot of other people as well. He substantiated Bible hopes. Would it shock you if I told you that young man was on a pastoral staff in the state of Indiana at a large church? I don't think so. The point is, friend, it all started that day. When he learned what faith does, some of you will never see what faith does because you keep hitting the chicken exit. I'm begging you, young people, just to stop trying to figure it out on your own and just follow Jesus and trust him to enable you to do what you thought you could never do. And then watch him do it, and you'll have evidence that will drive you to conviction about things you cannot see. Could I ask every head bowed, please, and every eye closed? Heads are bowed and eyes are closed. Heads are bowed and eyes are closed. And I'm going to ask a couple questions. How many say, preacher, this week, God has brought me to make a decision, publicly or privately. I know there's been many public decisions, but God has led me to make a decision, publicly or privately, and I'm not ashamed of that decision, and I do want it to be lasting. Maybe it's getting things right with your parents. Maybe it's getting a sin issue out of your life. Maybe whatever. I don't know. But you say, preacher, God has been brought to a decision for Jesus, and I want it to be a lasting decision. I've made the decision publicly or privately, but I've made a decision for Jesus, and I want it to last. Put your hand up and hold it there. Just put it up there and hold it there. Don't put it down. Okay, you can put your hands down. Thank you. Number two, how many say, preacher, I've not been brought to a decision this week, but the message this morning, this morning and perhaps right now, stirred my heart that I realize I need Jesus. And God showed me that my self-dependence is going to work in my Christian life. And although I've not made a decision, God is stirring me about the fact that I need to trust God enough to obey him, total surrender, total dependence, And although I've not made a so-called decision, God is stirring me about that truth. Would you raise your hand? Anyone at all like that? Okay, thank you. Put your hands down. Here's what I'm going to ask. If you raised your hand and meant it, then I'm going to ask you here in just a moment to come to the front, wherever you can. If the front's filled, certainly go just where are you on the aisles. But I'm going to ask you to move. Because I think getting out of the boat, so to speak, an illustration of that is good. Movement's good. You're saying you believe God enough to obey Him. I'm going to ask you to simply come and kneel. And I want you to spend some time telling God, God, I need you. I want you to work in my life. I need you to change me in this. I need you to give me the strength to talk to my parents. Some of you may already have done that. But whatever the next step is, God, I need your strength to have victory over disrespecting parents or whatever. But if you raised your hand and meant it, then I'm going to ask you to come and kneel, and I'm going to give a few moments for you to pray what I call declarations of dependence. I call them I need you God prayers. It's God, it's Lord save me prayers, like Peter did when he started to sink. Heads are bowed and eyes are closed. I'm going to ask you, don't be ashamed. If you're ashamed, obviously you're not trusting God. Fear man brings a snare, but whoso puts his trust in the Lord shall be safe. If you fear man, you won't trust God, but if you trust God, you won't be afraid. Heads are bowed and eyes are closed. If God's touched your heart, made a decision for Jesus publicly or privately, or perhaps God's touched your heart, you've not made a decision, but you know you need to trust God. God's dealt with you about self-dependence. Whatever. Either way, you raise your hand. I'm going to ask you right now, break and head to the front. Would you do that? Just head right to the front. If you can, go right to the wall first and then right behind. Made a decision for Jesus publicly or privately, not ashamed of it, or God's touched my heart about self-dependence in my life. Once the front's filled, just fill the aisle. But I'm going to ask you to get out of the seats, if you would, please. Come all the way at least to an aisle and kneel there. Now, I realize there's two kinds of people seated. Number one, people who are right with God, people who are living in dependence upon God, and you did not need to respond. And I'm certainly grateful for you. I know your heart is right now rejoicing, and you're certainly praying. But there may be somebody who's been fighting God. I don't know. But heads are bowed, eyes are closed. I'm going to give a few moments. And young people, I'm going to ask you, do not go back to your seats. Just stay right where you are. It's too jammed right now. It'll distract. Just stay right where you are. And I'm going to give just a few seconds, a few minutes or so. And I want you to pray right now. And I want you to say, God, I need you. God, I need you. Would you do that?